Okay, I want to again thank the Comrades of Socialism, who organized the Socialism Conference, for inviting me to give this talk. Let there be light. Okay. Across the capitalist world today, there's a clear political polarization. As the policies of the neoliberal center continue to deliver declining living standards and working conditions for the mass majority of the world's inhabitants, more radical alternatives have gained a mass audience. The dominant alternative, unfortunately, has been a right-wing populism that targets both the global elites, with the Jews, of course, at their core, and immigrants, racialized people, women, and LGBT folks as equally responsible for the current social crisis. The defeats of mass struggles and the failures of ostensibly left governments to end austerity, particularly most recently in Greece, has demoralized many and fed the radical right. However, we are also seeing the rebirth of a mass, although politically heterogeneous, socialist left across the capitalist world. In this country, the astronomical growth of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, has made socialism a small but significant political force in this country for the first time in 40 years. As minorities of working people and militants are again looking to a socialist alternative to capitalism, we have seen the revival of the discussion of how to organize for the transition to capitalism, a revival of the debate on socialist strategy. Unfortunately, in my opinion, some have presented this debate as between the advocates of a democratic versus insurrectionary road to socialism. In my opinion, this debate, which revisits the key issues discussed by Kautsky, Lenin, Luxembourg, Trotsky, and others in the pre-1914 socialist movement, is not between Democrats and insurrectionists. Instead, I would say, on one side, are those comrades who believe that the working class and oppressed can use all or parts of the existing democratic capitalist state to abolish capitalism and build a socialist society. On the others are those like myself who continue to argue, who believe that the existing democratic capitalist state is fundamentally undemocratic and cannot be permeated by working people and molded to meet our goals. Instead, the existing capitalist state must be dismantled, or in Lenin's phrase, smashed, and replaced with a new and more radically democratic political institutions that embody working class and popular power. Now, these strategies are based, I'm going to argue, implicitly or explicitly in different theories of the capitalist state. As we'll see, there's no one-to-one correspondence between theories of the state and socialist strategy. Many of those on the many on the left have defended theories that are in some ways at odds with their politics. However, different visions of how we will organize to transcend capitalism, and by the way, to fight for immediate demands under capitalism, assume different understandings of the relationship of the capitalist state to the process of capitalist accumulation and competition on one side and the struggle of social classes on the other. Today, I want to examine the theoretical underpinnings of different socialist strategies in order to determine their logical coherence and whether they are based on a realistic understanding of capitalism, class struggle, and the state. Only such an assessment of these theories will allow us to determine whether the strategies they inform, are realistic or utopian. The classical reformist political strategy put forward by the Social Democratic parties after 1914 and the Communist parties after 1935 prioritize electoral politics, winning office in the existing capitalist state. Once the Workers' Party or parties assumes office through elections, in this strategy, they will carry out a series of political and economic reforms. Politically, a socialist government would attempt to democratize the existing state. For example, establishing proportional representation for the legislature and making sure that the executive branch is directly accountable to legislative bodies. Economically, socialists in office would strengthen trade union rights, expand social welfare programs, nationalize selected industries, and use monetary and fiscal policy to promote economic growth, full employment, and higher wages. For some reformists, especially those who came out of the communist parties, these political and economic reforms will initiate a piecemeal transition to socialism. For others, particularly those shaped by post-World War II social democracy, the reforms will effectively balance the interests of capital and labor, guaranteeing stable economic growth and allowing enduring improvements in the workers' standard of living. Now, I'm going to argue that the classical reformist theory is based on what has been called an instrumentalist theory of the capitalist state. This theory is often not presented in an explicit fashion, but rather is embedded in empirical and historical analysis of the relationship between the leading personnel of democratic capitalist states and the capitalist class. A careful reading, however, of the work of radical sociologists like C. Wright Mills and G. William Domhoff, and the early work, particularly his 1969 book, The State and Capitalist Society, by the Marxist sociologist Ralph Miliband, allow us to identify certain key elements of this theory. The close personal, economic, and political ideological ties between the capitalist class and the leading state personnel determine the class content of the state institutions. In this theory, capitalists possess economic power derived from their ownership of the means of production. The state personnel's place in the state institutions give them political power, the ability to make and enforce political decisions. Capitalists become both the economic and political ruling class through their ties to the state personnel. Campaign donations, direct participation of capitalists in government, the power of business lobbying organizations, and the role of corporate-sponsored policy planning networks. Put simply, in this theory, the state institution, the state apparatus in Marxist terms, is a neutral instrument, an empty shell, whose content is filled by whoever occupies it, and it can be wielded by a variety of social forces. For this theory, if the working class, through its political party, can displace state personnel linked to capital, the existing state can become an enduring tool either for enduring reform or gradual transition to socialism. Now, most of us in this room, no matter our strategic differences, understand that the classical social democratic strategy is a dead end. All of us could probably cite ad infinitum example of how election of reformist governments have led to some combination of capitulation and abandonment of reforms in the face of capitalist resistance. Mitterrand in France, the ANC in South Africa, the MAS in Bolivia, and most recently Syriza in Greece, or have opened the road to capitalist repression of the workers' movement. Spain in the 30s, Chile in 1973, Venezuela today. This strategy failed not primarily because of a lack of commitment on the part of social democratic politicians. Allende was serious about bringing socialism to Chile. Mitterrand, and the Socialist Party in France was serious about initiating a transition to socialism. But it failed because it is based on a utopian understanding of the relationship of the capitalist state to accumulation and class struggle. On the one hand, the laws of motion of capitalism, in particular the dynamics of competition and profitability, gravely limit what any government can do under capitalism. As long as political leaders are not ready to decisively break with the logic of capital, capital's ability to withhold investment in the face of policies that reduce profitability or undermine competitiveness is usually sufficient to guarantee that the reformists will fail. if a government is actually committed to radical reforms and implements them in the face of capitalist economic resistance, the structure of capitalist state institutions will allow capitalists to bypass the elected branches of government and use the military and police to violently crush any challenges to its rule. In sum, I think most of us will agree that the state is not some neutral instrument that either capitalists or workers can wield for their own distinctive and antagonistic goals. Now, for much of the 20th century, there have been two strategic alternatives to social democratic reformism. The first is a variant of what Hal Draper called socialism from above, where a self-proclaimed armed revolutionary vanguard destroys the existing state and establishes a single-party dictatorship that rules in the name of working people. For most of us in this room, I hope, such an alternative is a political anathema. This strategy deepens the popular equation of socialism with bureaucratic class rule, defends regimes that were doomed to social and economic failure, and make revolutions the voluntarist act of an armed elite rather than democratic self-activity of working people. This strategy has led the global left to adapt their political strategy to the political and diplomatic needs of states that purport to defend socialism but actually undermine it at every step. Put simply, revolutionary socialism from above, Stalinism, is a dead end. The other alternative, reformism, which I will be clear, has not commanded the support of a significant portion of the working class since the 1930s, is revolutionary socialism from below. This strategy recognizes that the existing state is a mechanism of capitalist domination. Revolutionary socialists argue that only the independent self-organization and self-activity of working people can either win concessions from capital reforms or transcend capitalism through a revolution. Reliance on routine collective bargaining, lobbying, electing pro-labor candidates to office rarely wins significant or lasting reforms. For the most part, massive, disruptive, illegal struggles, mass strikes, occupations, etc., are the way that working people raise the cost of capitalist resistance and force capitalists to make, albeit temporary, concessions to our side of the class war. The transcending of capitalism, from this perspective, will require the dismantling of the existing capitalist state institution. Now, this strategy is often caricatured as imagining a simple frontal confrontation between a revolutionary counter-government and a monolithic capitalist state. In reality, revolutionaries, going back to the days of the early Comintern, have advocated and have organized, in a sense, within the existing capitalist state. Not only do we run in elections primarily to promote popular struggles, but we seek to build independent organizations of state employees and the enlisted personnel of the state military to challenge the legitimate authority of their superiors. Put it another way, revolutionaries should be trying, both in their day-to-day public sector, trade union activity, and any defense of the rights of enlisted military personnel, to promote, as we do in the private workplace, widespread insubordination among civilian state personnel to their supervisors, and ultimately mutinous actions among enlisted members of the armed forces. In a revolutionary situation, committees of state workers and soldiers could challenge the discipline exercised by unelected state bureaucrats and military officers, short-circuiting capital's ability to derail or repress popular struggles. Along with committees elected in workplaces and communities, they are the basis of a radically democratic alternative state, which will dismantle or smash, in Lenin's terms, the existing capitalist state, in particular its core repressive institutions. Now, while Marx and Lenin formulated the key elements of this strategy, they did not present an explicit theory of the state, either in the Civil War in France or in Lenin's State and Revolution. In the 1970s and 1980s, Marxists such as Joachim Hirsch in Germany and Nikos Poulantzas in France began to elaborate what we can call a structural relational theory of the state that I believe supports a revolutionary strategic vision. Hirsch's work begins with Marx's discussion of capitalism's laws of motion and capital to provide a clear understanding of the relationship of the capitalist state to the process of capitalist accumulation, competition, and crisis. Places the state not as something separate from, but as part of the ensemble of capitalist social property relations. Poulantzas's work focused on the relationship of social classes and their struggle to the capitalist state is a bit more problematic. Poulantzas's intellectual debt to Louis Althusser and his political formation in Maoism mar his contribution in a number of ways. An idealist theory of knowledge, epistemology, which easily detaches theory from reality and practice, marked Althusser's Marxism, leading many of its adherents in the 1980s and 90s to embrace post-structuralism, postmodernism, and the like. What E.P. Thompson labeled a ventriloquist structuralism systematically downplayed the role of collective class practice, the self-organization and self-activity of the working class. Not surprising, many Althusserians, including Poulantzas, were drawn to the politics of Maoism, a variant of socialism from above. As Simon Clark pointed out in the 1980s, for the early Poulantzas, quote, the revolution is made by the state, the appearance of a new state presaging the appearance of a new mode of production, and not by the activity of the exploited classes. However, I do believe there are theoretical insights that can be extracted from Poulantzas's work that are central to our understanding of the capitalist state. Now, the capitalist state, from this perspective, is not, as some have claimed, a loosely interconnected set of institutions whose social character is given by the social ties of its leading personnel, but instead, a fetishized form of the capital-labor relation. The basic logic of capital requires that the capitalist state institutions appear institutionally separate from the process of accumulation and from any particular segment of capital. The reproduction of capitalist social relations takes place generally through the dull compulsions of the market. Direct political and juridical coercion is usually not necessary for workers to be subjected to capitalist exploitation. The threat of unemployment is enough. As a result, the capitalist state appears as a sphere of public authority, separate from the private sphere of exploitation and accumulation. The structural separation of the political and economic under capitalism strictly limits capitalist state economic policies. This is why no socialist government can use the existing state institutions to abolish the laws of motion of capital. Concretely, the relative autonomy of the state from accumulation gives capitalists the structural capacity to discipline state personnel through investment strikes and the like. Now, the capitalist state is also the material and institutional crystallization of capitalist class relations, of capital's domination over labor. To paraphrase Poulantzas, the state and its institutions organize the class struggle of capital and disorganize the class struggle of labor. To unite a capitalist class riven by competition, the state must be autonomous from any individual capitalist or group fraction of capital. Segments of capital, particularly in the democratic form of the capitalist state, may have close ties to certain state personnel or branches of the state apparatus. However, the state as a whole has a measure of autonomy, so it can provide the institutional framework to overcome those divisions and create a consensus among the capitalist class. The hierarchical and bureaucratic relations that mark capitalist state institutions, from the elected legislature to unelected civil servants in the military, ensure labor's disorganization. Working people appear within the capitalist state in two ways. On one hand, they appear as atomized citizens with legal juridical rights subject to capitalist domination through the rule of law. On the other, they appear as a corporate entity represented by their official leaders, labor bureaucrats, the middle class leadership of people of color, women, LGBT groups, etc., whose interests are balanced with other corporate interests, business, consumers, the public. In neither case are workers present in the capitalist state as a collective force capable of disrupting capitalist rule. In all cases, the price of admission for representation within the capitalist state is eschewing the forms of organization that allow working people to exercise power, massive, socially disruptive, and usually illegal forms of struggle. The concrete relationship of the forces between capital and workers in any society shapes the various forms of the capitalist state: democratic, dictatorial, fascist, civilian despotism. However, none of these forms, including the most democratic institutions of the state, can be wielded by working people to secure enduring reforms or initiate a transition to socialism. Polonsis, despite his later strategic wavering, which I'll discuss in a minute, was quite clear on this. The state is not an entity with an intrinsic instrumental essence, but is itself a relationship, more precisely the condensation of a class relation. This implies that political domination itself is bound up with the existence and functioning of the state apparatus. It follows that a radical transformation of social relations cannot be limited to a change in state power, who has office, but has to revolutionize the state apparatus itself. In the process of a socialist revolution, the working class cannot confine itself to taking the place of capital at the level of the state, but also to radically transform, to smash, the apparatuses of the state and replace them with a working state apparatus. Now, here we get to what everybody's really interested in. In both historical and contemporary debates on the capitalist state and social strategies, there have always been comrades in the socialist movement who sought middle ground between the classical reformist and revolutionary strategy. Many today are actually looking quite self-consciously to the writings of Karol Kautsky to envision a transition to socialism that combines, as equally important, winning power in the state through democratic elections and building organs of popular power in workplaces and new neighborhoods to support a socialist government's anti-capitalist policies. Both Ralph Miliband and Nikos Polonsis, despite their sharp theoretical differences on the state, ended up embracing a very similar strategy in the late 1970s and early 1980s. More recently, my friend and comrade Mike McCarthy attempted to elaborate and update Polonsis' argument in his analysis of the democratic capitalist state. In this version of the theory, the institutions of the democratic capitalist state are neither simple instruments to be wielded by either capital or labor, nor a monolith that is impenetrable by working people. Instead, the democratic form of capitalist rule is presented as, quote, a set of loosely interconnected institutions that are sites of struggle, whose relative autonomy, quote, from any specific class or class fraction, can allow them to be turned against their capitalist masters as working class struggle sharpens the contradiction between the state's functions in guaranteeing accumulation and ensuring legitimacy. While recognizing the advantages capital has in its relationship to the institutions of the democratic capitalist state, workers can force through policies that strengthen their position in relationship to capital, both through electoral victories and mass organizing that can lead, in a certain historical conjunctions, to a transition to socialism. Now, I believe this strategy is actually incompatible with the notion that capitalist state institutions, including democratic ones, are the materialization of capitalist class relations. I think there's a theoretical inconsistency between Polonsis' theory and the political strategy he and people who follow his later writings draw. Instead, it ultimately reverts back to an implicit instrumentalism where the working class can, in fact, use segments of the capitalist state institutions to effect pro-working class reform and initiate a transition to socialism. In both the conclusion to Polonsis' last work, State Power and Socialism, and McCarthy's recent contribution, there's a very subtle conceptual shift. The understanding of the democratic capitalist state as one form of the institution of a capital-labor-social relation is recast as the notion that the democratic capitalist state becomes a site of struggle between social classes. In the original formulation, which I believe is most accurate, the capitalist state's bureaucratic and hierarchical form facilitate the constant reproduction of capital's domination over labor by organizing the capitalist class and disorganizing the working class. In the later formulations, the state institutions become relatively level playing fields, where the working class, through their own electoral, political party, and mass organizations like unions, can seize parts of the state apparatus to ensure durable reforms and possibly initiate socialism. This notion of the capitalist state institutions as a site of struggle confuses fundamentally the struggle for democratic rights and pro-working class reform with the defense of democratic capitalist state institutions. Clearly, the relationship of forces in any society will shape the form of the state. There's no doubt that workers' struggle take place on a very different and much more advantageous terrain when there are democratic freedoms, free speech, free press, most importantly, the right to organize, than under various forms of capitalist dictatorship. It is also absolutely the case that working class struggle can compel capitalists in the state to grant reforms that improve the lives of workers and enhance their capacity to struggle. However, both democratic rights and substantive pro-working class reforms are rarely, if ever, won through the existing capitalist state institutions. Instead, they are won and defended by mass and disruptive social movements, out which operate and violate the outside the rules of the game of the capitalist state. The struggles in the United States that won union recognition, ended legalized segregation, created and expanded social welfare programs, all required lawbreaking on a massive scale. As we have seen time and time again, when working people and oppressed people stop engaging in mass disruption and seek to advance their goals through the state, through electing people with the right ideas, lobbying, participating in state agencies and state-sanctioned collective bargaining, they are unable to either win new reforms or defend old ones. This dynamic of demobilization and retreat is not accidental, but it flows from the structure of the capitalist state, the way it institutionalizes capitalist domination over labor. The price of admission to a place in the capitalist state institutions for the responsible representatives of the workers and the oppressed is accepting the rules of the game of these existing institutions. This involves a willingness to abide by the law, which usually restricts the ability of working people to actually exercise power. Now, this could be seen very clearly in a non-revolutionary period. Let's look at the United States during the Second World War, when the US labor movement was offered a place at this table in the capitalist state institutions. Both the AFL and CIO were given representation on a variety of wartime boards, charged with everything from the allocation of labor to various war industries to the regulation of wages, hours, and working conditions. The ticket to this dance, however, was renouncing the workers' most powerful weapon, the right to strike. The labor officialdom hoped that their participation in the state administration of the war economy would initiate a process of the social democratization of the US economy, where unions would have a permanent role in administering the economy in this state, and the economy, and the state would protect workers through universal social programs. Instead, labor's wartime participation in these state agencies hothoused the bureaucratization of particularly the new industrial unions as a system of industrial jurisprudence based on grievance procedure displaced strike action over workplace issues. As shop floor activism, the cellular basis of workers' power, was stifled, the labor movement as a whole was weakened. Rather than winning a public role for labor and production, capital after the war regained, untrammeled control of private investment, and control of the labor process, and substantially weakened the legal rights of unions through the Taft-Hartley Act. Instead of a universal single-payer healthcare system, Social Security provisions that provide all retirees with an adequate income, and a massive program of public housing, U.S. labor was reduced in the post-war period to negotiating private welfare states, where workers' health care and pensions were subject to the profitability of their employers. We all know how well that worked out. And accepting a racially segregated program of federally sponsored individual home ownership. When the post-war boom came to an end in the late 1960s, this labor movement proved incapable of defending even the marginal gains of the 1930s. The string of defeats that began in the 70s and 80s was the direct result of labor's reliance on participating in capitalist state institutions across the world, has deepened working class passivity and cynicism, the enduring basis of capitalist legitimacy. Workers don't go, oh, this is the best of all possible worlds. They just say, nothing else is possible. And open the road to the populist far right. If attempts to struggle within the democratic capitalist state institutions are a dead-end strategy for winning and defending reforms under capitalism, it is even less effective as a strategy for socialism. The failure of both classic reformist strategies and attempts to find a third way between reform and revolution are rooted ultimately in the utopian character of a strategy based on capturing all or part of the capitalist state apparatus for working people. The very structure of the capitalist state, its relative autonomy from accumulation, and its bureaucratic structure make the institutionalization of capitalist domination over labor and thus make it impenetrable to the goals and aspirations of working people. A consistent advocate of the middle road between reform and revolution might argue that organs of popular power in workplaces and working class neighborhoods could check capitalist resistance from the unelected civil service and military without a frontal assault on these institutions. In reality, however, for those organs of popular power, popular institutions, to actually defend a radical socialist government's policies, they would actually have to begin to act as a substitute state to block resistance from the military and the bureaucracy. Working class and community councils would have to displace and probably arrest the permanent civil service, who's attempting to undermine any possible attempts at significant reforms in the economy, etc., while councils of soldiers would have to defy the legitimate authority of their officers. Put simply, the organs of popular power would have to frontally assault the core institutions of the existing capitalist state and replace them with a working class state based on the highest form of working class self-organization, workers' councils. If such a radical socialist government did not pursue these tactics, which would ultimately involve an armed confrontation with the repressive core of the capitalist state, they would be reduced either to administering capitalism and austerity, as social democrats have for generations, or they will end up like Allende in Chile. Now, I'm not insane. I'm not a member of the Spartacist League. We are clearly not in a revolutionary situation today anywhere in the advanced capitalist world. Although I believe the legitimacy of democratic capitalist political institutions is not as stable as some have claimed, as evidenced unfortunately by the rise of right-wing populism across the world. It is also the case that we have seen very few full-scale revolutionary crises in the advanced capitalist world with their stable capitalist democracy. The most important crises we've seen are really in periods when less democratic, more dictatorial forms of the capitalist state have gone to crisis. most importantly Germany in 1918-23, Spain in 1936-37, and Portugal in 1974 and 75. Now today, the task of the socialist left is rebuilding a militant minority of working people capable of promoting independent struggles and independent political action that will again make socialism the common sense of a significant minority of working people. In this task, those of us who advocate a revolutionary socialist strategy will find much practical common ground with our self-described democratic socialist comrades who are seeking a third way between reform and revolution. Whether it is building rank-and-file workers' organizations in the existing unions or unorganized workplaces, organizing militant demonstrations against the internment of migrants in concentration camps or the defense of abortion rights, we can work together to resist reformist pressures to elect good people and respect the limits of capitalist legality. However, our different understandings of capitalism, the class struggle, and the capitalist state can impact how we approach these struggles. In particular, in the coming years, we will again have to decide, do we seek long-term alliances with the forces of official reformism, the labor and NGO bureaucracy, progressive Democrats, and others who rely on the existing state in day-to-day struggles? Or will we accept the limits progressive unions and movement leaders place on mass disruption? Or will we commit ourselves to the permanent and independent organization of rank-and-file activists capable of taking action independently of, and if necessary, in opposition to the forces of official reform? Will we prioritize electoral campaigns whose main goal is winning office, which inevitably leads us back into the Democratic Party, the graveyard of the social movements? Or will we seek to organize election campaigns that promote ongoing social struggles, which I believe will require an organization independent of the Democratic Party? These are the burning questions today, and the answers we give to them will be shaped by our theoretical and strategic vision of the road to socialism. Thank you, Congress.